Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm here with my dad, John Wyatt. How are you today, John?
Yeah, good to be here and talking about another mind-boggling subject.
That's right. Yes, today, moving on a little bit from the last few weeks, we're going to tackle, should robots have rights? An odd question, if one you haven't thought about before, but something which is actually... When you dig into it, quite an interesting, fascinating one, particularly when it throws up how we should respond to some of these debates as Christians. You've been focusing quite a bit in the last few years of your work, haven't you, John, on research into artificial intelligence and robotics, including last year you co-authored, well, you co-edited a book about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could argue that I am completely... unqualified, you know. It's never stopped me in the past talking about things, but you know, because I'm neither a computer specialist nor am I a theologian, you know, I'm a baby doctor. But through my experience in, you know, being fascinated by advancing technology, one of the interesting themes which came out time and time again is it seems to me that whenever technology advances, it seems to raise an age-old question about what it means to be human, but often with new and interesting guises. And so, you know, my history working as a doctor, it was often things like, you know, keeping tiny premature babies alive, you know, was it ever right to switch off the life support machinery? What about abortion? What about reproductive technology and embryo research? And what about the persistent vegetative state when someone's got such severe brain damage that they're not really conscious? So the technology is raising the question about what does it mean to be human? And the reason I've become fascinated by AI and robotics is that I see this as like the next big wave that's coming along that is, lo and behold, raising that question again. What does it mean to be human in the light of advances in AI and robotics?
I don't know if you noticed... the thing when you first look around this question of should robots have rights, what comes up time and time again is a rather bizarre set of events in 2017 when a supposed robot called Sophia was given Saudi Arabian citizenship. I don't know if you saw that story at the time.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, isn't it? Because it received a lot of profile, a lot of interest, and it shows. It's to me, it just reflects the fact that there's a sort of abiding fascination, at least among some people in our society, both a sort of sense of excitement about, you know, maybe it's possible that robots are now becoming like people, but also a kind of dystopic fear. What is the future leading us into?
The creator of Sophia claimed on American television that his robot was, quote, basically alive. In October, that he brought the robot to the United Nations, telling the delegates at the General Assembly that it was here to help humanity create the future. It's worth stressing, before we move on, this is all mostly kind of PR nonsense, and in effect, it's actually just a kind of a well-crafted replica of a human face with some motors behind it to move the eyes and mouth, and it can do some pre-programmed responses, but it's not it's not alive. And it was actually, mostly, I think the citizenship thing was mostly ginning up some interest in some Saudi tech investment conference. But it raises a fascinating question about why, as you say, why are people so fascinated with this idea that are robots equivalent to us as people?
It's a nice word which has been coined to describe robots that are basically fake like this, and they're faubots, F-A-U-X, bots.
That's good. Yeah, very much a faubot. But it tapping into an idea that's really been quite present, mostly in science fiction rather than actual reality, for almost, well, over 100 years, hasn't it, really? This idea of when or if we have robots which actually are genuinely autonomous and can have some sense of intelligence, what kind of status, personhood should be bestowed upon them?
Yeah, and I think the role of science fiction in all this is utterly fascinating, and it's something that hasn't received enough attention. But if you think of all the big technological advances in history, you know, things like the invention of the steam engine and the Industrial Revolution and electricity and so on, the technological advance came first, and then the novelists come along, you know, so then Charles Dickens comes along and writes his novels about the Industrial Revolution and so on. But what has happened here is that for more than 100 years, creative writers and novelists and filmmakers and so on have been inventing, creating a whole series of issues and questions and fantasies. And long before the technology has come into force. And that very, all that creativity is actually influencing the way that the real life physical technology is developing. Most of the people working in Silicon Valley and elsewhere in the robotics and the AI industries are science fiction devotees. You know, they grew up with this stuff from the from their mother's womb.
And one of the writers, I mean, it's worth stressing before we move on, the word itself, robot, actually was first coined not by a theorist or a scientist, but by a writer, a Czech playwright, actually, who derived it from, I think, a word in many Slavic languages, robota, which means kind of forced labor or serf. So even from the beginning, the word robot is not a neutral term. It kind of evokes a sense that these beings are equivalent to kind of slaves or serfs.
That's right. And also in that very first play, the story was about these robota, these serfs, who then were in a factory but took over. There was a revolution. And so that's an example of where this kind of fear of the robots taking over is something that's been explored repeatedly in literature, and Isaac Asimov was in fact a key player in all this. And you were just telling me before we came on air that you used to read Isaac Asimov the paperbacks that were lying around at home.
That's right. Yeah, you had a number of them on the shelves, remember? And I remember stumbling across them when I must have been a young teenager, maybe 12 or 13, and devouring these kind of slightly pulpy novels, but really interesting ones about, in particular, a whole series of short stories he did, based in a kind of future universe where we created this thing called a positronic brain, which is kind of like an autonomous software that acted like artificial intelligence. And so it was a whole series of kind of little short kind of thought experiments about what would happen if a robot that was autonomous did X, Y, and Z. But what kind of undergirds the whole thought experiment is Asimov came up with these three laws of robotics, which in his sci-fi, the kind of all robots are built with these three laws baked into their hardware as a kind of constitution or a bill of rights almost. And just quickly run through those. So the first law is a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. The second law is a robot must obey orders given to it by humans, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And then the third law is that robots must protect their own existence as long as that doesn't conflict with the first or second law. And then a lot of the books kind of tease out the contradictions and the gaps and how human beings in a world where they knew robots are bound by these laws might interact with them in really interesting, kind of fascinating ways.
That's right. And really the whole point about the Asimov stories is just illustrating how those laws, which seem relatively straightforward and obvious, lead to all kinds of unexpected consequences and turn out to be much less effective than you might think. And certainly now we're getting to the point where autonomous robots are, creators are talking about trying to bake in, as you say, certain fundamental rules. It's turning out that, unfortunately, Asimov's three laws are far too crude and vague, open to interpretation, and they don't really work in the real world.
Mm. And it's fascinating to me that, you know, these Asimov books, you know, they weren't new when I was reading them in the early noughties. They were already half a century old. Another 20 years has passed. So sci-fi is so far ahead of the curve. But actually, we're just now at the tipping point where this is starting to be a real world pressing concern, where real policymakers and legislators and lawyers are actually seriously thinking and about what rights and liabilities, rights and responsibilities should we give to autonomous beings. The one kind of real world example that comes to mind immediately is around self-driving cars. As cars are given more and more autonomous capacities, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of debate and very little consensus, unfortunately, about what does that mean if a self-driving car, you know, causes a crash, or even in the worst case scenario, actually harms or kills a person. Who is responsible? You know, can you prosecute a self-driving car for dangerous driving? Do you go after the manufacturer? Do you go after the car's owner? Do you go after who was in the passenger seat at the time? You know, all these questions, and they're not simply theoretical. You know, there are real, you know, there was a case in America where a Tesla, which was on its so-called autopilot feature, the driver was distracted, not letting the Tesla drive itself down a freeway or a road somewhere, and it hit, I think, a cyclist, was it, or a pedestrian, and sadly killed her.
That's right, and it turned out the sensors weren't able, because of the particular lighting characteristics, the sensors weren't able to detect this somebody, I think, walking a bicycle who was crossing the road and was killed. So I think there are very real concerns about these autonomous agents and the need for laws and rules. And there has been some discussion about whether or not autonomous agents could be given, granted some kind of legal status as a legal person, because we know that other entities, it's possible, for instance, for companies to be granted status as a legal person. So some people are suggesting maybe we should grant autonomous agents the possibility of being seen in the law as persons.
Well, I'm no expert, but that sounds like a fairly interesting way of maybe squaring the circle of going a kind of a middle way between we're not comfortable about giving robots equivalent legal status and rights as human beings, but clearly they need to have more rights than a lump of metal like a dumb car that can't drive itself. What do you think about this idea of giving them legal personhood in a way that some companies have?
Well, I think it's, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm aware of the fact this is fiendishly complex and challenging and difficult. And one of the very fundamental ideas, which is very important, of course, is that rights and responsibilities are always go together. Wherever there are rights, there are also, in some sense, responsibilities. And so if we make a robot or an autonomous agent, if we give it rights, what are the responsibilities of that agent? Is that agent to be held responsible for its activities? So, for instance, if a company is a legal person and a company activities lead to harm, then that person is held accountable, and you know, the company is held accountable and can be sued, and money can be removed from the company, and so on, fined, and so on. But does that make any sense for a robot, that we're going to fine a robot? Are we going to imprison the robot? Are we going to? It doesn't make any sense, really. And that's just one example of how granting legal personhood seems to open up other all sorts of complexities.
It potentially raises as many questions as it answers. I understand you were saying that this issue of kind of legal personhood for robots is an under active discussion by the European Union in particular, which is kind of trying to formulate its policy around that. And I know at least there's at least one briefing paper that's been produced by the EU, which is quite critical of the idea, because it says, you know, the fundamental conceit behind giving legal personhood to companies is that companies are comprised of people, whereas a robot doesn't have the same people behind it to fall back on in that sense if they're acting genuinely autonomously.
Yes, that's right. And I think, you know, these are issues under active discussion and debate at the moment in the EU, in the States, elsewhere across the world. And my impression is that at the moment there's no real consensus on what the best way forward is, but there is a general recognition there definitely need to be rules, there need to be regulations. But the question of rights raises fundamental questions about how we should respond to these beings. And it's not just about liability for things going wrong. It's also about our human reactions to, particularly to humanoid robots in our midst.
I think the humanoid thing is a really critical thing because, you know, for decades now, you know, in particular, lots of manufacturing has involved robots, in particular, kind of car assembly lines. It's a major part of kind of high-tech manufacturing is you have these semi-autonomous machines which basically assemble things at great speed or lift and carry things that obviously human beings would be too small or take too long to do. And no one is really interested in or cares about assigning them status, citizenship in Saudi Arabia or personhood to these kind of clumsy, huge metal machines bolted to the floor, often surrounded by cages to prevent them from accidentally pulverizing their human co-workers. But it's when we start to see more humanoid robots that actually feel and look a bit more like us that suddenly it muddies the waters and people are like, hang on, I don't feel comfortable just treating that like a slave in a way that we effectively treat some of those non-humanoid robots like slaves.
Yeah, so that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not just robotic systems which appear like human beings, because it also applies to robotic systems that seem to be like animals. An interesting study done by Kate Darling, a researcher at MIT, and she got together groups of volunteers and she gave them all these little small robotic dinosaurs to play with. And then after she'd spent time and they'd really enjoyed playing with these little dinosaurs, she asked them to tie them up and then to kill them, and gave them a hammer in order to destroy these robots. And what happened was that these little robots were programmed to whimper and to say, "Oh, I'm hurt, please don't hurt me," and so on. And interesting, obviously the study was to see how human beings would respond to this. And she said that many of the participants refused to hurt the robots and said they felt uncomfortable because the robots were whimpering and they felt sorry for them.
So that kind of implies that it's quite easy to kind of short circuit humans' instinctive empathy. And even when a robot doesn't feel or look anything like us, when it's a miniature dinosaur, if it seems to be sentient, if it seems to be experiencing pain, our kind of inbuilt protections against causing kind of harm and suffering to people like us kicks in, and we feel deeply uncomfortable about treating it like a kind of inanimate lump of metal.
Well, that's right. And actually, if you think about it, you would probably be much more worried about the people who were quite happy to smash the brains of a dinosaur while it was whimpering or screaming in apparent pain. You would think that says something really quite unpleasant about that person, doesn't it? I mean, is that really, are they acting humanely?
So I guess what the line of thinking here is that the question of whether robots are people is secondary. The bigger question is if they're enough like people that we might need to give them protections and rights, because simply abusing them dehumanizes us by doing it. And so we might want to give robots the status and dignity of persons, even if we're not sure they are people, just because we feel like if we allow humans to abuse and degrade them and treat them like slaves or serfs, it actually just mars our own humanity.
That's right. And there's obviously some kind of analogy here with, you know, the very stringent animal legislation there is in many countries, including here in the UK. I mean, you know, if someone was to physically abuse a kitten or a puppy, they could be guilty of a very serious criminal offence and be sent to prison. And yet we don't have the same kind of laws protecting octopuses or other sentient animals. So why is it that we as a society feel that it's right to have such strong criminal law to protect kittens and puppies? And is it, and of course part of it is because of a concern for these animals, that they can suffer and be abused, and of course that's quite right, but is also an element of it that we feel that it says something about us as a society. We don't wish to be part of a society that treats kittens and puppies as disposable and be available to be tortured at will.
And I guess that question of sentience and feeling harm, it is really critical, because the question is then, can a robot, even an incredibly sophisticated, genuinely artificially intelligent robot that might come to be in the next 50, 100 years, who knows, can it feel suffering or pain or harm in the way that, you know, even a relatively unintelligent animal like a cat can? You know, we know that a cat feels pain. How could a robot that doesn't have flesh and blood and neurons and nerve endings feel harm, even if it was incredibly sophisticated and autonomous?
Yeah, and the common sense response is this is all rubbish. We know that machines are just machines and don't feel everything. But it's not as simple as that, because, you know, there are many people who would argue that human beings are, in the end, very sophisticated combinations of wiring and cells and all the rest. And yet we know that human beings are conscious and are sentient and aware of pain. And so are we really confident that a highly sophisticated a robot, which has the same kind of level of sophistication as the human central nervous system, are we really confident that that could never become conscious or aware or sentient or suffer pain?
This reminds me of a story someone shared recently that was in the Telegraph, which was saying that robots need a bill of rights now, and the government should start drawing one up before conscious artificial intelligence actually comes into being. And this call was coming from something called the Sentience Institute, which describes itself as the first and only AI rights organization. And their kind of argument is, even if they're entirely, you know, made of silicon and copper wiring and plastic, if a robot can do things like, you know, learn via trial and error, focus attention on harmful stimuli, have mood-like states, goal-directed behavior, it is effectively sentient and therefore needs to be kind of given the same moral and legal status, at least the animals that other sentient animals like dogs and cats have. What do you make of that argument?
Well, yes, it's a powerful narrative. And of course, it goes along with a narrative which is very common, particularly in sort of liberal circles. And that is that, you know, if we look back in the history of society, we see now that only a small group of human beings were originally regarded as having full human personhood and rights, and they were mainly white European males. And then as society progresses, gradually the circle of moral rights expands to include European women and then people from other nations and backgrounds, and And then the moral circle continues to expand and starts to include certain animals, primates and dolphins and cats and dogs and so on. And then it is argued that we're about to have the next stage, that the moral circle is about to expand further and is going to include certain categories of sentient machines.
I guess the problem I have with that argument, one of the problems, is that there seems to be a category distinction between even like highly sentient animals and machines, in that other human beings and other animals are not created, owned, manufactured, controlled, brought into being by us. They exist off their own accord, whereas all forms of machinery, artificial intelligence and robotics are fundamentally made by us. And that seems to be quite morally significant. Couldn't you make the case that, like, it's wrong to treat another human being or an animal as a slave because they have a dignity that comes from their independentness of us, but a machine, however sophisticated, however much it might mimic sentience, it might be programmed to whimper when you break it apart, but it's fundamentally, it's been created for a purpose, and we are at liberty to kind of tear it down and build it up for something else, just like we might do with any other kind of tool.
Yeah, and this is a deep philosophical discussion, really. Is dignity something that is inherent, that comes from the way I am made, or is dignity something that is conferred? Is it something which we as a society agree to confer? And that's an ongoing debate, but it isn't immediately obvious that dignity or the rights and personhood have to be intrinsic, that they cannot be conferred, that we as a society say this being appears to have all the characteristics of being sentient and of being conscious, and therefore we choose together as a society to confer on it the same rights as other human beings have.
And I guess, historically speaking, the whole concept, the whole discourse around rights fundamentally has been conferred. You know, we talk about today, because it suffuses our culture, this concept of inalienable universal human rights. But before 1948, or whenever the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was proclaimed and signed up to by X number of countries, they didn't exist. Or at least they weren't acknowledged and recognized and enacted and enforced. And maybe in that sense, we can say it feels like dignity and rights, you know, the right to life, the right not to be tortured, the right to freedom of expression, all this stuff that we feel is intrinsic. In pragmatic realpolitik truth, those have been declared and just assumed and arrogated by humans to themselves.
Yeah, these are very big fundamental questions, and a big question I've been grappling with is, how on earth do we respond to this from a distinctively Christian point of view? How does the Christian faith engage with some of these challenging questions? And it isn't immediately obvious. I mean, one of the fascinating things, I think, is that technology is raising a new challenges and questions which Christians have never really had to face before. And therefore there isn't a sort of strong stream of theological and biblical reflection. It's almost like we're starting with a blank sheet of paper and trying to work out on first principles how we should respond to this. And one of the things which strikes me, therefore, is that that's quite a dangerous process. It's perfectly possible that we could get it very wrong.
Yeah. And yet, although this is new and pressing, it taps into, as you said before, some really ancient biblical ideas around, you know, what does it mean to be human? You know, is our humanness given and received, or is it something we actualize ourselves? What does it mean to be made in the image of God? Who is made in the image of God? You know, so there's these really profound Christian themes running through what is a really, as you say, novel and unexpected question And probably something, if I can be a little cheeky, that's really going to be pressing for my generation. You know, you might not live to see the day of autonomous robots, Dad, but, you know, I expect to be here for at least another 50 or 60 years. And I think there's every chance by the time we get to the 2080s and beyond that this will not be purely the realm of science fiction, but it could be very much something that we have to live alongside.
Yeah, but I want my caring robot son. Don't forget, you know.
That's your real interest in this dynamic, isn't it, Dad?
Did you know that this month marks the 4th anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. So that's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I guess at heart of it, we were discussing last week is how do we categorize robots? Imagine a future when robots have gained artificial intelligence, a form of consciousness, maybe even sentience. Do we see them as morally equivalent to human beings, or are they still a separate category?
Yeah, that's right. And this is more than just an abstract philosophical speculation, because there's very active discussion going on in many centres around the world about the regulation of future robots or autonomous intelligent agents, and in particular, whether some kind of bill of rights for robots should be developed. Can a robot be regarded as a person for legal purposes? And what are the implications for Christians? How should Christians think about these extraordinarily mind-boggling new questions?
Mm. And I guess the first thing to say is, obviously, you know, you go combing through the scriptures for a proof text about robots and you're going to come up empty. But there is, I suppose, a kind of instinctual, kind of maybe automatic response from, I think, a lot of Christian thinkers, which is that there is something fundamental about humans which is different from anything else in all of material creation, including anything that we create as human beings, such as robots. And that's about the image of God, and therefore, you know, case closed, robots are not in the image of God, and therefore they can't be people.
Yes, and you can understand, you know, that immediate response. But I think we need to think a bit more carefully and deeply about this. You know, what often happens as technology advances is that there's an initial attitude of repugnance, a kind of emotional, non-intellectual response. That sounds ridiculous. That's yuck, sometimes called the yuck factor. And it's possible for people just to respond at that kind of emotional level without thinking deeply about what are the issues that are involved. And so I do think there is a real value in trying to to think more deeply about this. And one of the fascinating things, you know, you can see this in the history of thought time and time again, that as a new challenge arrives, a new way of thinking, which challenges Orthodox Christian thinking, it actually represents an opportunity, because it forces us to think more deeply and more carefully about the truth which we've found from the basic biblical foundations of Christianity. So I think there's a new opportunity for us here to think more deeply about what it means to be human.
And do you see that happening? Do you see theologians, church leaders, denominations kind of going back to this question that we might have thought was fairly settled about the nature of humanity and Christian theology? Do you see people kind of reopening that in response to the pressing issue of robotics?
Well, to be honest, it's still at a very, very early stage, this kind of discussion. I was given some money by the Temple Foundation in collaboration with the Faraday Institute in Cambridge in the UK to undertake a research project very much around these theological and philosophical issues. And so I spent a number of time approaching various heavyweight theologians and church leaders and asking them to collaborate in this project. And to be honest, I was quite surprised by some of them who were very dismissive and thought this was a complete waste of time and really not anything they wished to be involved with. And so I think there is a kind of reluctance for many serious theologians to get involved in some of these questions. And I'm not really understand where that reluctance comes from, but I suspect quite a lot of it is about the fact that so many church leaders and theologians come from a non-scientific background. You know, they come from the humanities and they've never been interested in science. They've never read any science fiction, and they just find the whole thing rather distasteful and uninteresting.
You know, speaking as a humanities person myself, who dropped all my sciences as soon as I could after my GCSEs, I have to say, like, I actually have a bit more sympathy than it sounds like you do for church leaders in particular. It's an incredibly busy, stressful job working in that sort of ministry. And to say, you know, you need to be urgently inquiring into the ethics of a situation which does not exist and, for all we know, may not exist in their lifetimes. It's certainly not round the corner, is it? The emergence of AI and genuinely autonomous, rational, conscious machines. No matter what the kind of Silicon Valley boosters would have you believe, we're not close to creating kind of Asimov-style robots. I can understand why a church leader says, do you know what, that doesn't seem like, on all the thousand things on my radar, the most pressing issue to be doing some reading and thinking about.
Sure. And I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that every church leader needs to be really engaging with these issues at that kind of level. Although, you know, I do think that church leaders need to start thinking about technology. I mean, yes, it's true that, you know, advanced sentient robots are maybe many decades away. But, you know, so many church members have got smartphones that they talk to. They've got Alexa and Amazon Alexa and Google Home, you know, especially the young people, you know, may well have virtual companions and using AI continuously. And surely these issues are vitally important even for your average pastor who's trying to support a church community.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the theology then. We mentioned briefly the kind of what you might call the traditional orthodox view, the mainstream view, which is that because humans are made in the image of God and robots are not, that is the key kind of bright dividing line. But and that carves off humans as an entirely separate category from the rest of the entire universe. And therefore, no matter how sentient, conscious, autonomous a robot becomes, it can never be equivalent to a human being and therefore should never be granted the same kind of dignity, personhood, status or rights as a human being. Do you find that argument compelling?
Well, I think there is a great deal to be said for it. As you say, this is the orthodox position, which you can trace all the way back to the New Testament writers and also to the early church fathers who saw both in God's way, the way that God had created human beings in his own image, but particularly in the incarnation, the fact that humanity is invested with special significance by Jesus of Nazareth coming in the form of a human being, and the destiny and dignity of human beings is very much then tied up with the figure of Jesus Christ, and this unique status that that is given to him. And I, for one, have been very much influenced by theologians who've emphasized that perspective. And I've been coming out of the project that I mentioned is a book called The Robot Will See You Now, published by SBCK in the UK, but it's available internationally. And two of the theologians who did agree to be involved were Stephen Williams and Robert Song, both eminent professors of theology. So Stephen Williams really defends what you could see as the orthodox position, and he places the emphasis particularly on the fact that human beings are essentially related to God. He says that humankind has been constituted by God to be in relationship with him, and that this is something that, however sophisticated an AI or robotic system is, it can never be essentially related to God in the same way. And he also emphasizes the importance of embodiment, that our humankind, the way that we're created, is to be embodied, and that the hope for the future of humanity is not in some kind of disembodied virtual state, but is with a resurrection body. And this differentiates us from a digital, disembodied kind of artificial intelligence. So he argues that the question we have to ask about robotics is how does it help us to thrive in our essentially human kind of being? And if robotics is going to some way interfere with this thriving, then we should resist it. If, on the other hand, it's helping us to thrive, to become more human, then we should welcome it.
And there does seem to be some real merit to that idea, because it grounds us and our status and identity not as kind of ourselves, not something that we self-actualize, that we kind of create our humanness from ourselves, but it says no, it's a gift, it's received, it is a reflection of the only kind of true original force in the universe, which is God himself. Whereas, and that seems to me both kind of consonant with Christian theology and quite a kind of a good, humbling, safe place to stand when thinking about what sets us as apart as human beings.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think this is a very important theme, isn't it? That in a secular, liberal understanding of what it means to be human, this idea of self-definition, of autonomy, that I am a unique experiment in living, I'm creating my own identity. These are very, very powerful ideas within the secular world. And in fact, many people would regard this Christian idea that our identity is given us by God as being somehow demeaning, isn't it? I mean, I should be able to create my own identity, to decide whoever I am.
Mm. And that's actually the essence of all sin, is ultimately a desire to remove God from the throne and place ourselves upon it. What key way how that works itself out, as you say, is about saying I'm going to refuse to allow myself to be bordered and structured and boundaried and hemmed in by another, by God, and I'm instead going to say, no, I'm in charge, I can decide, I can rule, I can reign, I can determine what I am, who I am, what is right, what I can do.
Yeah, and there's a line in a Christian song which says, I am who you say I am. And I often think that is extraordinarily deep and profound, you know, that ultimately it's God who defines who I am, both generically as a human being and uniquely as a unique person. And I want to be more of the person who God says I am.
And it's something a robot cannot say, because a robot says, I am who I've been programmed to be by a human, another part of created order. I am made in the image, not of God, but made in some sense in the image of the software designer or the robotics company that created me.
Yes, I mean, that's fundamentally right. And of course, again, from a Christian theological point of view, made in a fallen image. I mean, made by fallen human beings, contaminated by evil, and therefore the product of our hands is also contaminated by evil. I think an AI coder would want to come back and say, yeah, but sophisticated autonomous machines are not deterministic in that sense, you know, in that the software is designed to explore possibilities and come up with novel solutions. And you know, there are many examples where AI is coming up with genuinely novel solutions, which no one else has ever, no human being has ever worked out before. So I think you can't say that the AI is just doing what it's programmed to do, but nonetheless it is constrained by the way it's been created by a limited and fallen human being.
So that's kind of Williams's position. You said the other theologian you had in the book was Robert Song. Does he argue a different line?
Yes, Robert Song, again, very eminent professor of theology in Durham. And he, I mean, there are lots of similarities. I don't want to overstate the differences, but there are some interesting and subtle differences between Robert Song's position and that of Stephen Williams. And what Robert Song comments on is the fact that it seems that as the robotics and artificial intelligence advances, something that we thought was uniquely human suddenly turns out, oh no, robots can do that as well. You know, robots can compose music, robots can write novels, robots can drive cars, etc., etc. And he said it's almost like the citadel of human uniqueness is under constant attack, and a little bit gets lopped off each time. And he says the danger is that Christians want to say, oh yes, but there's still something unique about human beings, and that is being constantly threatened by advances in the science. And he says that we shouldn't worry about AI and robots doing more and more, or we shouldn't worry about the upgrading of robots. What we should worry about is the downgrading of human beings. And he says it can be a bit like the God of the Gaps, that historically in science, whenever there was a tendency that whenever science couldn't explain something, the Christians would say, oh, well, that must be God. But understandably, as science advances, that seems that God does less and less. And Robert Song is saying it could be the same danger, that as the technology advances, what's special about humanity becomes less and less.
So in this framing, the kind of definition of humanity is not grounded on the imago Dei, but is instead grounded on our capacities, whether that's our consciousness, our sentience, our creativity, our rationality, our spirituality. It's about capacities rather than identity.
Well, what Robert Song would say is that the essential uniqueness of human beings is in our calling. And he would relate this to the imago Dei, but he would say that the way we image God, well, the way we reflect God in the creation, is primarily by our calling to represent God to the whole of nature through the creation mandates to subdue the earth and to multiply and to fill it and to bring, to cultivate in the image of the garden, that human beings are the cultivators, bringing out the richness of creation. He says that's our unique calling, and that nothing can threaten that, however advanced the robots become, even if they appear to take on consciousness and other forms of human functioning, they can't threaten our unique human calling.
And so in this sense, he's fairly relaxed about the potential advent of autonomous conscious machines, because he would see them simply as another example of humans cultivating created order. You know, we've taken these raw materials of metal and silicon and plastic and electricity, and we've created something entirely new. And it might be so new that it actually has a kind of consciousness, a sentience, a life. But that doesn't matter, because no matter how alive it is, it hasn't got the same calling that we have.
Yes, exactly. So whereas Stevens Williams' view is would lead to a great deal of caution about wanting to defend human uniqueness, and therefore I think would tend to resist the idea that a robot could be a person, I think Robert Song's view is more positive towards technology in general, prepared to see how God may allow us to bring these new entities into existence, and that we should welcome them, not be threatened by them.
But I suppose, does Robert Song explicitly... Sorry, I'm about to sneeze. Right, I'll start that one again. But I suppose, does Robert Song actually address the kind of question we started with, which is, should robots have rights and responsibilities of personhood? So he might say, I mean, I guess the question is, do our rights and dignities as human beings come from our calling, or in which case we shouldn't give them to robots? Or is he saying, actually, it's fine to give robots the rights and responsibilities of personhood because the calling aspect of our humanity remains distinct, but there's no reason why we should restrict the status and dignity of personhood only to those who have that special calling from God?
So he doesn't explicitly address the issue of robot rights in the chapter in which he's written in the book I and Stephen Williams edited, but these are active areas of discussion which we as a group of a multidisciplinary group we've discussed amongst ourselves, and I think there isn't a clear answer. There are more issues to discuss here, but I just want to raise a third Christian response, and that is the response that Michael Rice has put forward, and he argues that the human beings are fully physical, that there is no mystical, immaterial part of being human. And yet, what emerges out of our central nervous system are these phenomena of consciousness, of rationality, and our ability to relate to other people and to relate to God. These are, he describes them as emergent properties coming out of the central nervous system, out of the wiring of our brains and so on. And since that has happened to human beings, he argues there's no fundamental reason why that can't happen within the circuitry of an artificial intelligence. And therefore, he says that we should be prepared for the fact that at some point these machines are likely to become sentient, to become conscious. And at that point, we should give them the privilege of personhood. They should be regarded as robotic persons and maybe of equal status to human beings.
Hmm. Do you think this is kind of outside the bounds of kind of Christian orthodoxy when it comes to the kind of physicalism of it? Or do you think that's actually you can hold that view while still kind of holding on to fundamental kind of Christian convictions about the Imago Dei and that kind of thing?
Well, there certainly are a group of Christian scientists who are adopting this fundamental view about what it means to be human. I would say they represent a minority amongst philosophers, Christian philosophers and scientists, but they are definitely a significant group, and they argue that human beings... it is our physical nature that is at the heart, and that the aspects that we think of like consciousness and free will and our ability to relate to God, these are emergent properties. So they would fundamentally be would say that there is nothing but matter, that what constitutes human beings is a materialistic reality. Now, the alternative view, the philosophical view, which is probably more common amongst Christian philosophers, would be some kind of dualism, sometimes called a substance dualism. In other words, that there are two quite distinct aspects to being a human being. There is the physical component of which our bodies are made, but then there is this other component, a completely immaterial, non-physical aspect, which might be called soul or spirit, and that the human being is a combination of these two kinds of reality.
Yeah, I just reflecting on how that fits in with the kind of Judeo-Christian framework in scripture, I guess you have that kind of theme that runs through both Old and New Testaments of like the breath of God. In Hebrew, that's ruach, which can be translated, I think, as wind, breath, or as kind of spirit and soul. And there's a kind of fundamental ambiguity there about, you know, what that is. But it is a clear idea that humans were made out of the dust and then God breathed into them. And it's the combination of the breath of God and the kind of dust of the earth that creates humans. So I can see there is a kind of consonance there running at least through Old and New Testament.
Yes, I think what most biblical theologians would want to emphasize is that the biblical, particularly the Old Testament Hebraic understanding of humanity, is that we are a unity, you know, that there is a fundamental unity about being human, but we have many different aspects. We have material aspects, we have physical being. I mean, the Hebrew often talks about the heart and about the kidneys, about the flesh, about the nefesh, which is some kind of the soul, and there is this, and the ruach, as you said, and the human being is a complex unity of many different aspects, some of them physical, some of them immaterial. And what is fascinating, you know, is that the advent of robotics and artificial intelligence means that these kind of discussions become more than just interesting theological, philosophical speculation, because all of a sudden it really matters how we understand what it means to be human from a biblical Christian point of view is going to make a huge difference to how we respond to advancing robotics and AI.
I mean, one thing that strikes me, if we take that third position, the kind of more optimistic, the Rice position, that potentially consciousness and personhood could emerge from future kind of complex autonomous robots, then we have to think about how we relate to them spiritually. You know, are they capable of having a relationship with God? You know, do they need to be evangelized and ultimately saved like we do? I guess it raises some interesting novel questions that maybe similar to what would happen if we discovered kind of sentient alien life. And we kind of think, how do we fit that into our anthropology as Christians?
No, that's exactly right. And it's a very interesting and instructive parallel to think through, you know, as thought experiment. So if NASA announced, you know, next week that they'd established contact with an intelligent species on a distant planet in another planetary system, how would we think about these beings theologically? Would we think that these are beings that are related to God and that we should preach the gospel to them? How should we respond to them? And in the same way that it is analogous with an artificial intelligent species on Earth, because we would have the same difficulties. We wouldn't really know what it felt like to be that alien species any more than we know what it feels like to be a computer. But we would assume that there was something it did, there was some kind of subjective awareness. And so we reach out to them, I think, with humility, with compassion, with love, and with respect. And so that's a very interesting thought experiment, which which you know, we have to engage with, we have to think about.
We're kind of coming to the end of our time, but just before we leave, I want to really press you. You're much more of an expert on this than I am. I'm very kind of new to this idea, but which of those three views, if any, that we discussed earlier, do you find most compelling yourself? Do you see you kind of landing in the kind of agnostic position? We're not really sure, or do you lean towards the more traditional, the more optimistic view?
I lean towards the orthodox position that Stephen Williams has espoused. In other words, it seems to me, if we take the whole way that Christians have been thinking for 2,000 years about the uniqueness of human beings, I think we want a very strong reason for throwing that away. My default position would be that we should protect the uniqueness of human beings, and we should be concerned about the possibility of a kind of deceitfulness of a counterfeit personhood, which could be very manipulative and misleading, and that's this sort of blurring between what it means to be human and what it means to be a machine. But I suppose I would have to say that I wouldn't want to absolutely rule out the possibility that at some stage there might be a machine that God, in his surprising grace, gives the gift of personhood to. I don't think I have any right to say, no, God would never do that. That would be completely outside his purposes. I mean, what right have I to say what God's plans and purposes are? And it may be, it's possible that at some stage in the future, it becomes apparent that God is giving the gift of personhood to some new advanced kind of machinery.
Hmm. What a world that would be. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? But I suppose that's what we have those sci-fi writers to kind of dream big dreams and sketch out alternative futures for us to try and think these things through. And just lastly, then, we mentioned at the beginning that your kind of frustrations at the fact that not many kind of theologians and thinkers are delving into this. Would you be encouraging kind of church leaders and theologians to kind of push this issue up the agenda, up the priority list of future study?
Well, I don't want to overstate it. And I think that for the average, church leader, the most important issues are the issues I mentioned before, things like smartphones and use of the internet and so on. But I would hope that the theologians and Christian philosophers would be more prepared to engage with some of these issues, because I do see them as important, not least because they tell us more about what it means to be human.
Hmm. Great. All right. Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks as ever, John. And thank you to everyone for listening. I hope you enjoyed this kind of pair of episodes about robots and rights. Robots and AI, as we've discussed, is something that John's been working and researching on for a few years. So it's definitely a topic we're hoping to come back to in the future. But if you want to go find out more about this issue, the best place to go would be to the book that he and Stephen Williams co-edited last year, The Robot Will See You Now. We'll pop a link to how you can get hold of that in the description of this podcast. But as ever, there's also loads of other material on technology and AI and robotics on John's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Anything else to say there, John, about stuff coming up in the future?
No, well, I'll be aiming to put up some more articles on my website dealing with some of these issues, and always very interested to hear comments and feedback. This is very much a discussion we need to be holding amongst ourselves. So thanks so much for those who have responded, and looking forward to the conversation in the future.
Mm. As ever, if you'd like to get in touch with us, it's really easy. You just can send an email to molad@premier.org.uk. Otherwise, thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
C Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.